Currently, 26-year-old Marshall Iwasa is taking a drive to see his mother. He has just spent the day doing chores around his home in Calgary. His trip comes at a time where he's currently on break from college. But he has yet to inform members of his family that he's failed to enroll in the next semester. Perhaps he just wasn't ready to tell his family he needed a semester off. Or perhaps he had gotten involved in something else. Only he would know the true answer as he continued his 2-hour trip towards Lethbridge. But after his arrival and a short visit with his mother to help her with her computer, at around 11 p.m., Marshall would be set to hit the road again. You see, the other reason that Marshall came to Lethbridge was to pick something up from his storage unit. And the original plan was to take a quick trip to this storage facility located in the industrial park of Lethbridge. Then after this quick errand, it would be a straight shot back to Calgary. And while Marshall wished his mother a good night and set out that one evening, as far as anybody else was concerned, after this brief visit, it was back to school and back to business as usual for Marshall. But unbeknownst to his family, Marshall had stopped attending classes some time ago. It wouldn't be until 6 days later that some hikers would make a strange discovery. This is the Felix Creek Trail in Pemberton, British Columbia. The path itself extends from an old logging road that later breaks into an open valley that cuts up north to a location called the Brian Waddington Hut. This location is maintained by a volunteer outdoor club which allows individuals to spend the night up there, assuming they register online. The trail itself is well off the beaten path, so much so that it's often cited as a location where you're not likely to run into anybody, especially if nobody was scheduled to be up there. But on November 23rd, 2019, one post would signify a rather dark discovery, where James M. Stark would write,
"Had a crazy experience this weekend trying to get to the Brian Waddington Hut. We took the 4x4 trail all the way to the trailhead, and when we arrived, we came onto quite the scene. There was a burnt-out pickup truck that smelled very fresh. In addition, there were possessions thrown all over the area, including 2 passports, 3 smashed cell phones, a smashed laptop, ID cards, toiletry bags, and clothing. It felt like a crime scene, and we had a very eerie feeling. We turned around and left, deciding not to hike to the hut, with a fear of walking into something. Obviously, our whole group was thinking about the Canadian manhunt from the summer. We called the police and reported it. I thought the community would like to know before anyone drives 4 hours to a trailhead only to be turned around."
This truck was Marshall's, It had been found in a matter of days, a staggering 14 hours away. The car was completely torched. The steering column was removed, but Marshall was nowhere to be found. The truck had been discovered right at the end of the logging road, right where the path morphs into a hiking trail, meaning whoever did this drove the car as far as they possibly could into the woods. Of the items that were found at the scene, this included a large amount of clothes, ID cards, two passports, three smashed cell phones, and a smashed laptop that all belonged to Marshall. But that being said, not all of the items were his. While there's been a number of videos on Marshall's disappearance, there's a thread of this story that often gets overlooked. And the thread I'm referencing in this case is a separate rabbit hole of information that seemingly ties Marshall's case to another missing person's case from this time. This other individual I'm referring to is Daniel Riach. He disappeared under equally bizarre circumstances just 3 days after Marshall's truck was found. Since then, family members of Daniel's have identified a wide array of work items found at Marshall's truck as belonging to Daniel. And in an even more recent development, it seemingly confirms the connection. But that being said, we'll circle back to his case here in a moment. Because in regards to the original discovery, by the time the RCMP had reached the scene, it appears as if someone had tampered with the evidence.
We have a bunch of items that used to be in the box that are now spread out, broken, and it looks like water, ice poured on it. Things are strategically placed or broken. Some of it's just completely removed.
This, again, is a very remote area. It was very difficult for us to get there. So it's difficult to think that in that small window of 2 days when our hikers that took the photos were leaving, that someone knew who wasn't involved with Marshall's disappearance happened to go up there and move these items. And our hikers that took the photos, they've never mentioned seeing anyone there. We've never seen any logs of anyone being out there.
As fate would have it, it seems that Marshall never seemingly returned to Calgary. While it would take some time before the family was notified of the situation, upon checking back in with the storage facility, it was revealed that after Marshall had left his mother's home, he seemingly spent the entirety of the night trying to get into his storage unit. But there was a problem. The facility was closed. While the actual surveillance footage was deleted by the time the family had been notified, keypad records had shown that Marshall had input his access code various times over the night unsuccessfully. But it appears that Marshall had waited there throughout the entirety of the night until he successfully gained entry at around 6 a.m. After getting into his unit, he would go on to spend 2.5 hours inside until he left at 8:24 a.m. After this exact point, there's no further details about his whereabouts. His financial trail goes cold, and while it doesn't appear that he returned home, it definitely raises the question of what Marshall needed to get from his storage unit so desperately.
Yeah, okay, so do you know why he was in the storage room?
So he needed a box for a piece of his computer. So he built his own computer. He was a computer guy. That's what he was originally going to school for. And he needed to send a piece away because his computer was broken. So he was looking for something to do with his computer.
Okay. Yeah. And he was in there for 2 hours.
Yes.
Okay. And I guess that's normal. I don't know. I mean, especially if you haven't been back to your storage room in a long time and if it's really full.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was last there in August. So it's not like he was there all the time. But yeah, since then, the storage unit has been searched and nothing is weird about it. Everything seems normal. Everything is still there.
While Marshall's family insisted that there was nothing missing from the unit, it's worth mentioning a couple things for context. The first of which was that Marshall had spent about 800 hours developing a video game, and from what I can assume are backup timestamps, it appears that he had been working on the game the morning of, prior to heading to his mother's. Given this detail that he was working on a passion project, I can see how this would create some urgency to retrieve whatever part was necessary. But on the other hand, the other thing I should point out is that Marshall had seemingly packed a bag at some point. With all of the clothes and toiletries found at the scene, this seems to insinuate some sort of planned trip after the fact, as Marshall was known to keep his trunk rather organized. Additionally, there were quite a few items that were never located, one of which was his hiking backpack, which seems to strengthen this idea that there was a packed bag in his car. But that being said, even if Marshall had been planning a secret trip after this visit to the storage facility, Marshall was not known to have any contacts out in BC, making these circumstances surrounding his trip to the storage facility undoubtedly strange. Generally speaking, finding a car burned off an old logging road is not a unique set of circumstances. It's actually a pretty textbook method of disposal, as torching the car leads to the destruction of DNA evidence. And generally, you see the removal of the steering column in cases where extra precaution is taken, as in some cases, DNA swabbed from a steering wheel has led to various convictions.
In the Bienville National Forest, a body found inside a burned-out car. This burned-out car you see here during a worker's early morning walk.
Yavapai County Sheriff's Office investigating a suspicious death after a body was found in a burned-out car.
A man's body and a burned-out car found near a construction site close to Grand Avenue. Deputies say the car was found on a logging road off Highway 155 near Montevallo.
Body was found burned in Pike Township in a wooded area near Eagle Creek.
A body found inside a burned car in Dodge County. A burned body was located Saturday morning inside a charred vehicle under Gum Swamp Creek Bridge.
Police found that burning car around 9:45 last night. Just beyond those pine trees is Interstate 40.
I think you get the point. This phenomenon is not just common, it's shockingly common. And the reason I bring this up in regards to Marshall's case is because of what happens next. Because after the RCMP had gotten involved in the following weeks, this would lead to a subsequent search of the immediate area, where their efforts would yield one final discovery. That being a path of burned clothes that started from the car and led to a nearby creek, where it, quote, appeared as if someone had caught on fire while the vehicle was burning. A subsequent underwater search had revealed nothing, however, and further efforts to locate Marshall were suspended, leading to a final statement given by police.
We believe that he was likely the driver. There's some personal effects around in the area, but there's nothing to suggest that there was anything suspicious that occurred.
Now, let's recap for a moment. A young man is missing. His car is found 14 hours away at the end of a remote logging road in an area he's not known to have ties to. His car is burned to an absolute crisp. His steering column is removed. There are items at the scene that aren't his. It appears as if someone had tampered with the scene after its discovery. And there's a trail of burned clothes leading to a nearby creek. Yet despite this mess of information, authorities would neatly tie it up by saying nothing suspicious had occurred. The mere insinuation that he did this on his own accord is absolutely ridiculous, especially when you factor in that Marshall had just recently paid off his truck. Yet, when push came to shove, and the initial search was called off within the first week of December, the Whistler RCMP would go on to insinuate that he just simply walked off into the woods. But come December 12, 2019, the case would be reassigned to the Lethbridge Police Department, where they kept the case open as a missing persons case. But despite new leadership, they would once again refuse to acknowledge any possibility of foul play, and instead would go on to cite Marshall's recent failure to attend college classes as evidence that he had become withdrawn. As a consequence of the authorities' refusal to classify this case as criminal, no forensic tests were ever carried out. And after the RCMP had collected the loose items found at the scene, they simply just left the car to the elements. As far as I'm aware, to this very day, if you hike this trail, the car is just sitting out there. But after the LPD had done a final search in June of 2020, the case would take a rather strange turn. After an exhaustive search in June, which yielded nothing, the family was rightfully frustrated by both departments who refused to classify the case as criminal. You see, given the fact that this case was technically a missing persons case, this created a bunch of red tape preventing the full pursuit of this investigation. And one potential lead that wasn't able to be fully investigated was the search for gas station CCTV footage. We know for a fact that Marshall would have had to stop for gas multiple times, and while Marshall's family did check the various gas stations on the way up to Pemberton, they were only able to check the footage with the various locations that cooperated on their own accord. But beyond that, additional frustration could be felt for the police not even allowing the family to view the items that were found. To date, we're only left with the various photos that surfaced online.
When Cassie was here, there was a lot of barriers with the Missing Persons Act in trying to get historical data of Marshall's movements prior to his disappearance. And I think that's something that we're still continuing to push for, is to get those answers and get that information. You know, and for me, one of the biggest things would be this fire investigation that, you know, just happened.
And no results yet, right?
Yeah, from what I've been told, they're still waiting on the fire investigator report, which is a month now. Just over a month from when they were up there, and a full almost 9 months since Marshall went missing. So, you know, I've wanted a fire investigator up there since day one.
Yeah.
And for them to just have one, I mean, I'm happy that one went up there when they did the final search that they just completed. But, you know, it's a little bit late and we're still waiting for that report. Because, you know, if it's considered arson, you know, that's criminal. And so that I'm hoping that we could then get it pushed into a criminal case, a criminal investigation.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems really strange that they would wait that long. Is there any idea why? I mean, to me, it seems like anybody could go out there and tamper with evidence, right?
And that was our concern from the beginning of having the trucks still being out there, is that it wasn't a controlled site.
This fire investigation would later be deemed inconclusive, which would bar Marshall's case from a criminal classification. And as you can imagine, leaving the car to the elements for 9 months definitely didn't help for clarity. But that being said, when the family hired a private investigator, his findings differed on the site. He had determined that the cause of the fire was arson, and the PI was even able to locate a source lighter at the scene. But despite these findings, this didn't appear to shake the LPD's opinion on the case, and come August of 2020, the family would launch a petition to manually push the case to a criminal classification. Shortly after the petition was launched and started to gain some traction, the Lethbridge Police Department would go on to issue a statement. The Lethbridge Police Service understands the family of Marshall Iwasa is seeking answers in relation to his disappearance, and we can assure the community the investigation will remain open and ongoing until he's located. A thorough and comprehensive investigation has been undertaken, and any and all new evidence or information that comes to light in the future will continue to be vigorously pursued. Iwasa, who was 26 years old at the time he was reported missing, was last seen by his relatives in Lethbridge on November 17, 2019. He told family he was returning to Calgary, but hasn't been seen or heard from since. He was reported missing on November 25th, 2019, after his burned-out truck was located in the BC backcountry. From the onset of the missing persons investigation, Iwasa's disappearance has been considered suspicious. However, as previously stated, there is no credible, corroborated, or compelling evidence to suggest foul play or that the matter is criminal in nature. Not all information and evidence in this case has been or can be shared publicly with the Iwasa family in order to protect the integrity of an ongoing investigation. LPS is aware of an online petition initiated by the Iwasa family to have the missing person case classified as criminal. However, in order for any investigation to be deemed criminal, there must be evidence to support that a crime has occurred. With respect to the Iwasa investigation, there is no such evidence and the matter cannot be reclassified at this time. No further comment or interviews will be provided in relation to this matter. Now, the public response to the statement was overwhelmingly negative, and for the various individuals who are following this case, they were quick to call out some perceived contradictions. First of all, it appears rather inaccurate for police to claim that they considered this case suspicious from the beginning, when we know for a fact that the RCMP initially stated that, quote, nothing suspicious had occurred, and then promptly closed the case. And second, it's typical for law enforcement to withhold information from the families to protect the integrity of an investigation, usually when you're building a case against a suspect. Yet despite this case being declared non-criminal, information is still being withheld at the expense of the family, which seems paradoxical given the circumstances. Additionally, members of Marshall's family have given statements that downplay the possibility of an investigation going on behind the scenes, instead insisting that they just never took his case seriously from the start. Because despite various new leads for this case coming in the coming months, the LPD would continue to ignore it. Foul play or not, arson is still a crime, and this statement was given as a way of diffusing the media attention the family was generating for the case. Given these circumstances, it definitely makes you wonder why the authorities are refusing to approach Marshall's case under the context of a criminal investigation. And this question only becomes more prominent as you dive into the second thread of this story. On the very same day that the police had reached the scene of Marshall's truck, another set of incredibly strange events would unfold about an hour down the road. At 10 a.m., 29-year-old Daniel Riok had been reported walking around Chikai Ranch in Upper Squamish, acting incredibly strange. He wasn't dressed for the weather. And at one point, the rancher had apparently spotted Danny walking in the street with his shirt over his head in freezing temperatures. Upon greeting the rancher, he would ask to borrow his phone, where he would go on to make a call to his uncle.
And so Danny takes the phone and he's like, "Hey, uncle, how are you doing?" And he started laughing and my dad was like, "What's going on? Like, are you okay?" He was like, "Oh, I'm living in another timeline right now." That's what he said. My dad's like, "Okay." And then he started laughing again. He was like, "Yeah, I love you, Unc." And then he could hear the man in the background saying, oh, I need my phone back. So the ranch owner took the phone back and then was like, okay, the RCMP are here. And my dad was like, yeah, just let him take him and we'll figure out what's going on after.
As a result of Daniel's strange behavior, he was taken into police custody for the day. But they inevitably released him at 5 p.m., as they had no reason to hold him. At 6 p.m., Daniel would be spotted on surveillance footage at a Tim Hortons on Progress Way. Then at 6:46 p.m., he would be seen on surveillance at a nearby Walmart. 15 minutes later, he would return to Tim Hortons once again, where he'd get a ride back to the Chikai Ranch area towards the Squamish Indian Reservation where his family was located. Then, later that evening, at 1 a.m., Daniel would be last seen by his aunt Katrina walking off the back deck towards Lewis Drive. As the last person to see him, she recounted that he had woken her up and told her that he had been fighting with a friend down by the river. At the time, she wrote the strange behavior off as him being intoxicated. But later that night, Daniel's car would be found idling with the lights on, where Daniel was nowhere to be found. It appeared as if Daniel had just stepped out of his car for a moment, as his cell phone was reported to be inside the vehicle. By the next morning, another family member had reported Daniel's vehicle as abandoned, where it would be towed and placed into the hands of the RCMP. But despite discovering this car in this state, no one on the reservation sounded the alarm and actually reported him missing. As the holiday season came and went, it wouldn't be until January 7th, 2020, 6 weeks later, that Daniel would be filed as a missing person.
So there was a space between the last time my wife, Deb, and I talked to him on November 25th and January 7th when I placed the got the missing persons report going. That's about 6 weeks. Apparently, no one knew anything. And that was a little bit disconcerting to us because nobody noticed that he was missing, even though he was living in a very, very small community. We've got a lot of questions about that, to which there doesn't seem to be any logical answers. But I think it was a little bit quiet on that front. As soon as we made the RCMP missing persons report, not everybody was now trying to be helpful.
Shortly after the missing persons report was filed by Daniel's great uncle, who did not live on the reservation, the police would go on to solicit some general details about his disappearance to the public. But despite these efforts and a later search effort, nothing was seemingly found. And to best understand Daniel's situation, I should state for a bit of context that Daniel had a pretty rough upbringing. He was an indigenous First Squamish Nations male who grew up without either parents. His dad was never in the picture, and his mother was a working girl who had him at the age of 14. April Riok, his mother, had been featured in a popular Canadian documentary called Through a Blue Lens. Produced by the National Film Board of Canada and released in 1999, it explored the world of addiction through troubled individuals in Vancouver's downtown east side.
Where do you see yourself in 5 years from now?
Well, I hope to see myself, you know, with my son in Squamish, or at least far away from, I don't even have to be, I can be next door from downtown, but at least far away in my mind.
A year after the film premiered, April was tragically found deceased in an alley on Christmas Day. Her passing the result of a robbery by an acquaintance. In turn, this would displace Daniel from the last of his nuclear family. And even leading up to Daniel's disappearance, he had seemingly been struggling to find his place in the world. Living somewhat nomadically, couch surfing between relatives' homes, and struggling with substance off and on himself, But that being said, Daniel had reportedly been making attempts to get his life back on track for the sake of his children. You see, Daniel was also a father. He was recently divorced, but when things were going well for him, he had steady work as a laborer for various companies. But despite Daniel's struggles, there's still a lot to consider when it comes to his disappearance. Because prior to vanishing, Daniel had reportedly become erratic, paranoid, had claimed people were out to get him, and he had multiple episodes that his family just weren't sure what to make of.
He sort of went through a weird period again where he had broke his hand, and my dad was going to bring him down. He was going to bring him down to North Vancouver for an operation on his hand, and he ended up going in the hospital, but then he didn't. He called my dad back shortly after and said, oh, I'm not having the surgery or something like that. And my dad picked him up and said, well, what's going on? He goes, oh, I'm not having the surgery or something like that. My dad was really confused by it. And then he just started going through a really weird period where he wasn't trusting people, or he wasn't, you know, he was suspecting that people were after him, that kind of thing. But he still, you know, was pretty happy. Like, he was a pretty happy guy. Just something was going on.
According to his cousin, in one instance, he left his rental in Squamish, took a bus to Winnipeg, broke into a local cabin, then turned himself into police. After being incarcerated, his grandfather then flew himself out to pick him up, where he then went to live in a new city for a few years. Additionally, in another strange set of circumstances, his uncle had discovered his kitchen door kicked open, with Daniel dazed and confused as to what was going on.
He just kind of, I don't know, had some sort of break or was on my dad. We were starting to suspect that he was on, but we weren't totally sure. And he had broken into the next door neighbor's house as well, too. He had broken in and was trying to find, I think, because his old best friend used to live next door. So it was, I think he was stuck maybe in the past or something like that. Like, he was thinking he was going to find his friend, and then he was going to, you know, he wasn't sure why my dad wasn't answering the door. I don't know exactly. But my dad ended up having to call the police and say, like, this has happened and I don't know what's going on, and he just seems really out of it. So the police took him. Then he was released later on.
Daniel himself had claimed that he experienced some form of psychosis as a result of his usage. Whether or not this was solely substance-related or rather brought on by a variety of factors remained unclear to members of his family. But obviously, evaluating the actions of an individual with bouts of irrational behavior is undeniably challenging when it comes to analyzing his disappearance. Not only was Daniel seemingly unpredictable, but he also seemed to give conflicting narratives regarding what was going on in his life. In one instance, Daniel told his uncle Rob that he needed to go to the hospital as a result of breaking his hand from punching a door. But over time, it was later revealed that Daniel had told others that his hand was shattered with a hammer by a group of individuals and he had been beaten up. This caused him to apparently go into hiding for quite some time, leading to him fleeing to a recovery center in Surrey, Canada. The only detail I was able to find here was that this hammer incident was allegedly in relation to something Danny had stolen. This was covered in the True North podcast, where they interview members of his family, but there doesn't seem to be any further details regarding who, what, or why. But here's where this gets rather interesting. Recall this earlier screenshot from Daniel's ex-wife. She also highlighted that around the same time, Daniel had been hanging out with one particular relative. This same relative could later be found on a thread regarding Marshall Iwasa's burnt truck, stating that they recognized various items at the scene as being Daniel's, but then later stated they didn't want to give out any additional information for their own personal safety. and within the same thread, they would go on to claim that they needed to have a private family meeting to discuss the nature of this case, and that they no longer felt comfortable discussing details publicly. Later on, the same individual would go on to delete their comments from the thread, but not before these comments were screenshotted by a member of Marshall's Facebook group. But after reaching out to Marshall's family about this particular thread, they are aware of this case potentially tying into Daniel Ryok, and based on my messages to Dawson, Marshall's brother-in-law, they believe this case to be connected and have kept an eye on this angle of the story. You see, the link that allegedly ties these two cases together was the red cooler that was found in Marshall's truck, which has been alleged by various members in the Facebook community to bear the name Cody Lewis. And on that note, to date, this is the first time this photo has ever been shared publicly, which seems to confirm the aforementioned. Now, this unreleased photo was provided to me by a member of Marshall's family, and initially this detail about the cooler wasn't known publicly to either family at all. The only reason this became public knowledge was because it was effectively leaked from an off-the-record statement by an RCMP officer to a witness who later would go on to post about it online. According to Dawson, the RCMP couldn't figure out who this Cody Lewis was, but this is rather interesting, as Lewis is a pretty predominant surname that runs on Daniel's side of the family that lives in the reservation. Within articles pertaining to the search for Daniel Ryok, it states the Lewis family is the one spearheading it. While Daniel was also last seen on Lewis Drive, Daniel also coincidentally appears to have a cousin named Cody Lewis. So, to reiterate a bit, while some of Daniel's relatives are afraid to talk publicly, others are identifying items found at Marshall's truck as belonging to Daniel. While one relative also seems to share a name with an item found at the scene. Given the fact that Daniel was couch surfing between relatives' homes prior to his disappearance, it seems plausible that a cousin's cooler could have come into his possession. But while this is speculation, once again, law enforcement allegedly could not figure out who this Cody Lewis was, and it seems that the official stance is that there's nothing to see here. But if this cooler doesn't have any relation to Daniel Ryok, the question then becomes, who was this other Cody Lewis? In either situation, this photo proves that police closed the door on this case while items that were found at the scene were obviously not Marshall's. Pair this with the ongoing fact that the authorities prevented the family from viewing all the items that were found, and this makes for a very questionable bit of police work. But nonetheless, the link between the two cases becomes even more interesting as we dive into the final thread of this story. A few months into 2020, the RCMP would be notified of one additional lead, where an eyewitness would go on to claim to have seen both of the missing men at one particular location back in November prior to their disappearances. The location is a bar called That Irish Place in Squamish, British Columbia. The witness is a local, a regular at the establishment, where he claimed to have interacted with both of the men while they were in the company of a third shady individual. According to the witness, the third man appeared to have power over what appeared to be Marshall and Daniel, where reportedly they were both noted to be somewhat distressed, after all of them had sat down for a beer at the bar. The witness would have a brief yet disturbing conversation with Daniel over a smoke, where shortly after, Daniel would be further observed heading back to the truck with the others. Notably, the witness would observe the truck idling in the parking lot for quite some time, where the truck was noted to have matched the description of Marshall's GMC Sierra with Alberta plates. And to quote the man directly, I have a now-deleted Facebook post that was in response to Daniel's second cousin, Sonia. Sonia, I'm very sure it was Marshall's truck in the parking lot outside of that Irish place in November of 2019. Marshall, Daniel, and the quote, scary dude, were sitting in it for a couple hours after the three of them had a beer 20 feet from me. I went outside for a cigarette and Daniel asked me for one. I asked him what those two dudes were doing sitting in the truck for hours. Daniel said, I think that guy's going to kill us. I did not take him serious and butted out my cigarette and went back inside. The bank machine was 10 feet from my bar stool and Marshall came in by himself and tried to get money. I sensed some distress from him and almost asked him if he was okay because I would have given him 20 bucks. He tried the machine three times without success, then went back out to the truck and got into the passenger side. The truck had Alberta plates on it. When I gave the RCMP an audio statement in March or April, after the statement, off the record, the officer asked me if I knew Cody Lewis. I told him I did and asked why. He said Cody Lewis was written on the lid of the red cooler in a permanent black marker. I did not know about Marshall being missing until I found this group in February or March. Then when I had seen Marshall's picture, I remembered him at the bank machine. I am 100% positive the two cases are linked. Now, while eyewitness testimony is notoriously unreliable, when it comes to this story, it's worth mentioning that this witness was a local, where he claimed to know of Daniel before this encounter. And it certainly does at least add to the credibility, given the fact that they were later proven correct regarding the cooler detail. But beyond that, on an even more strange note, in other retellings, the witness also claimed that on that same particular day, Daniel had left his guitar with the bartender, where in the coming days after his disappearance, the witness had also noticed that the police had come in to pick up the guitar as well, meaning that shortly after Daniel disappeared, police had in their possession his car, which also contained his phone, and his guitar. Yet this also in no way caused any alarm to sound for his whereabouts. Now, it goes without saying that there are a lot of unknowns in regards to this case. We don't have the full story when it comes to what transpired at the storage unit, and we don't even seem to remotely have a full picture on how this truck ended up where it did. But when it comes to things like the truck site, on one hand you have obvious hints of someone trying to conceal evidence with a fire, but then it seems like they also didn't get to quite finish what they started, with piles of loose items thrown about. It's almost as if the party responsible was interrupted, which could very well explain that weird trail of burned clothes leading to a body of water. There's also this additional unknown in regards to who or what tampered with the site after its discovery. While I suppose it's possible that wildlife could have been a culprit here, it's certainly quite creepy to read the hiker's fears about running into someone and then this happening. Continuing on, however, if you were to take a look at much of the discussion online in regards to these two cases on places like Web Sleuths or Reddit, a pretty persistent theory is that these two were potentially involved in some sort of illegal trade. One thing that seems to support this idea was the fact that Marshall had just recently paid off his truck, but his family could not account for what he'd been doing for work. You see, something that many people forget is the fact that storage units are often a hotspot for storing substances. They are often seen as a neutral territory because everything's under surveillance, and things can still be moved to and from as long as they're disguised. When it comes to the transport of these items over long distances, usually you see some sort of concealment device to remain inconspicuous if the person gets pulled over. Notably, hollowed-out electronics are a pretty common concealment device, and both a hollowed-out Xbox shell and PlayStation shell was found in Marshall's truck. Additionally, I should also point out that coolers are often another common concealment device, usually in the lining of the cooler. Now, as far as the smashed electronics go, the family has given some clarifying statements.
So there was also a laptop that was found out around his vehicle, right? Was it in good enough shape to be analyzed?
They gave us information that the police had looked into it. One, it hadn't been used for a while, like a few years. And I think from the timeline of it, I had thought that maybe it was one that we'd given him a long time ago.
Okay.
And my understanding of that laptop, too, is that it had fallen and got broken.
Okay. Even before it was found outside of the truck?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And the thing with some of those phones, too, is I know that there was articles that they were, like, smashed or broken, and that also wouldn't surprise me if those were the phones that Marshall had broken and had just left in his truck.
Beyond that, I should state that the police work on this case is a bit of a mystery, and in and of itself, I'm not sure what to make of it. Assuming we're sticking with the initial theory that the two men were involved in some sort of running, you may view the actions from the beginning as a tactic used to not spook a greater inquiry into organized crime. But if that were the case, you wouldn't expect this back and forth between the family and the authorities. Marshall's family claims there's been no such follow-through and that authorities have dragged their feet and ignored key pieces of evidence. Recall that it took authorities 9 months to conduct a simple fire investigation, and this detail to me in no way, shape, or form supports the idea of a hidden inquiry. It seems to suggest the mishandling of a case. Marshall's brother-in-law explained to me that the reason they never released the cooler photo was that there was, for a time, the impression that this side of the story was being looked into. But over time, it seems that opinion was shifted. While this is obviously my attempt to piece together the available information, at the end of the day, two men are still missing. A car is still sitting in the woods, and both families are still without any answers. While obviously I'd love to know what you guys think about all of this, this is Barely Sociable, and have a good night.